Hi there. This is Deb Mashek, the Executive Director at Heterodox Academy. I asked Chris for a minute on today's show to say thank you and to ask for your help. As you know, advancing heterodoxy in higher ed is neither a simple nor cheap affair. It takes many minds exploring many ideas and many tools employed on many campuses. Members and subscribers often tell us how much they appreciate our weekly curated list of readings, our nuanced engagement with challenging issues, the constructive tone we employ in our social media feeds and on this podcast, and the incredible sense of community they feel when they attend our events. Please demonstrate that you value HXA's always free contributions to the Academy by making a financial gift to the organization at heterodoxacademy.org. While you're there, check out our just-released annual report, which illustrates that HXA's efforts are making a real impact. And check out the roster of our amazing just-announced advisory council, an impressive range of higher education leaders and public intellectuals who have chosen to stand for HXA to offer support and guidance in our mission. Whether you are a member who has advocated for more constructive disagreement on your home campus, or a heterodox enthusiast who contributes to the discussion or who shares our content, thank you. Really, it is our honor to be doing this work with you.
Welcome to Half Hour of Heterodoxy, featuring conversations with scholars and authors and ideas from diverse perspectives. Here's your host, Chris Martin.
Phoebe Maltz-Bovey is my guest today. She's the author of The Perils of Quote-Unquote Privilege, Why Injustice Can't Be Solved by Accusing Others of Advantage, which was published in 2017. Her essays on privilege and politics have also appeared in The New Republic, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and other publications. She also co-hosts the Heterodox online show Feminine Chaos with Kat Rosenfeld. It's available in streaming video on bloggingheads.tv and as a podcast. We'll be talking about her book and some of her more recent articles. Hi, Phoebe. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
So you are the author of a book called The Perils of Privilege, and you've talked about privilege on your Blogging Heads show as well, and written about it. Tell me about what you discovered in the course of doing research about how people use the word privilege in academia and in just general discourse right now.
Well, so it struck me just years ago on just when I was a blogger and a PhD student, I was doing my PhD in French. So this didn't really come up so much in the coursework or anything, just like as I was in my spare time reading a lot of different blogs, that people were constantly calling out one another's privilege online. And if I say that now in 2019, it means something, it implies something different than what it meant when I was first noticing it, like maybe around like 2009 or so. So now if you say privilege without a context, it suggests, often it suggests white privilege, but it just suggests something a little bit maybe more more thought through in certain respects. Then it really meant like you're fancy, but you don't realize you're fancy, like you're posh, but you don't realize you're posh, or you're posh and you haven't properly sort of apologized for it, things like that. So that was how I first noticed privilege kind of in online discourse.
And that was just discussions among academics?
No. This would have been some academics, some lawyers, some just random people on the internet. I don't know who they were. A lot of feminist bloggers, all sorts of people were using it. In terms of where it comes up in academia is a little different. So basically, I noticed it first just in my kind of spare time activities as a, doing some journalism, also just doing a lot of blogging and reading internet comments. But in academia, it comes up in kind of a different way, which is just a lot of sort of, it functions as a way of avoiding discussing material, as in like money type issues. So rather than talking about how high tuition is at a school or like at a university, or in especially a US university, or talking about what percent of the student body comes from, like the top 1% of wealth in that country, you know, there will instead be a discussion about privilege, and privilege not meaning wealth, but privilege meaning, well, this is sort of what I explored and what I found. The most interesting thing I found in this was really to do with like college applications and admissions in the US, where you have to write to get into a top university, you have to write an admissions essay. And it's very important, like the most important thing, if you're reading about this online, the most, and I just know this anecdotally too, I'm American and went to the University of Chicago for undergrad, I'm, you know, aware of all of these things. You have to not seem privileged. It's paramount. You have to not come across as privileged. There, you can pay a lot of money to a tutor who can show you how to not come across as privileged. And what just amazed me about this is at the same time as there's this whole thing about like, don't mention your new Ferrari in your college application, you actually have to be very privileged, virtually have to be, to get into one of these schools to begin with, to attend the school and pay for not just the tuition, but the implied social life. You know, like if you just have scholarships, but, you know, don't have extra money for, you know, whatever the ski vacation everybody's going on, you know, maybe you'll be left out, things like this. And it's taboo to question this also. And that was another aspect of this that interests me. It's not so much what I explore in the book, but just when I think about it now. If you say that, I mean, I mentioned it briefly in the book, but if you say that you think privilege conversations are, you know, not great, people are going to assume that this means either that you don't think inequality is real, or that you think inequality is real but fantastic and you think everything's absolutely fine. So, you know, you sort of situate yourself in the cultural conversation in the place of the people who are saying like white privilege is a myth, male privilege is a myth, all of these things. And that's not at all where I'm putting myself in the conversation. That's not where I stand on these things. And I think that was sort of the trickiest aspect in a lot of ways with this book, is that I think people wanted it to be a few different things that it wasn't. I think some people wanted it to be privilege is a myth, actually, you know, it's everything's fine, or actually, you know, hierarchies are great, like existing hierarchies, or they wanted it to be, as the title, like the perils of privilege, like about how people who are on the top of whichever hierarchy are evil or something like that, which it isn't really that either.
And you found that people also tend to say, check your privilege. And I've read about this. I've never actually heard someone use it in a conversation. But part of your argument is that check your privilege tends to backfire and not accomplish much. So talk about that a bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the expression that I've noticed the most early on, and still I'm obsessed with it, is your privilege is showing. And where you see it will more often, I think, be online than in person. I've heard anecdotes about it, like in a classroom setting, but I think it is a very online phenomenon, which I don't think makes it any less real. And what I'm obsessed with about your privilege is showing is that it isn't telling you that it's a problem that society is structured such that you have these unearned advantages that you shouldn't have. It's saying that the problem is that the privilege is showing, okay? That if you were just discreet about your unearned advantages or had the etiquette, if you were even a little bit more posh and knew how to properly present your unearned advantages, that would be fine. And you see this a lot just in terms of, I keep returning to the topic of feminist essays, but also just women's lifestyle essays, although these two things have kind of, to some extent, merged in just mainstream articles, but just where unless the writer acknowledges her privilege, she will get a ton of feedback about how, she hasn't acknowledged her privilege. So that's where this your privilege is showing comes up. And this came up recently in a book review of the author Lindy West's new book, where a reviewer in the Times pointed out that Lindy West, who's a feminist writer, and writes about her own life and about ways she's been marginalized that do not happen to be the way, like, all possible forms of marginalization. And the reviewer took her to task for not spending enough time addressing the struggles, or the, no, not the struggles, sorry, the murders, in fact, of trans women of color, when that is not Lindy West's particular plight. She writes about being white and about being fat and about being discriminated against on the basis of her weight and her gender. But yeah, so basically, your privilege is showing, it's not obviously in a New York Times review, it wasn't your privilege is showing, but that approach really lives on. This is like a recent review. And the other thing, though, that is amazing about your privilege is showing is that people who defend talking about privilege in this way will say, well, it's not about you. It's not about you. That people who receive privilege checking as a personal critique are making it all about them, but it's not about them. But then you think about the expression, your privilege is showing it is about you. I don't think somebody's mistaken if they think it is about them.
Right. I mean, I definitely think there's, well, wherever you go in the world, there's divisions of social class, and you can take any two increments that are one above the other, and people in a slightly higher increment don't understand some of the things they can take for granted because of their position in the social class. So you could pretty much go to any position in the social, a person in any position in the social class, and say to them, at some point, your privilege is showing because you don't understand some of the comforts you have relative. Mm-hmm. So even someone pretty low is someone earning $20,000 a year can take certain things for granted that a person earning $5,000 a year cannot. So,
yeah, I mean, in terms of that, so this is really important. I believe that privilege is a thing and does make people oblivious to the situations that they don't know personally. I think that's 100% true. And if anything, that the way privilege discourse plays out obscures that, because I think it makes it seem as though it is an achievable, and it's not just that it's an achievable goal, that it should be the main goal of sort of social justice, is making people aware of their privileges. That that's really the goal, is making sure that everybody has checked their own privilege, has contemplated it properly and publicly in the right language in a way that makes everybody happy. And I'm saying that no, I think people are, all of us, whatever our situations in life, unaware of things we haven't dealt with. I think that's unavoidable and kind of the human condition. I don't think that you achieve anything sort of, I mean, I think it's fine. I think as a matter of politeness, it's good to sort of be self-aware in that sense. You know, it's like you're more pleasant to be around if you're self-aware. But that's not actually some sort of social justice commitment. If somebody has something due to structural inequality that they shouldn't, which is another, gets down another whole sinkhole topic of whether it makes sense to think of things as privileges if they're things everybody should have, and maybe not, but that's something else. But yeah, I just don't think that acknowledging, I think there's been this huge overemphasis, especially in academia, of on acknowledging privilege, on properly showcasing privilege. And it's just sort of, it's not even necessarily that it's instead of doing something about it, it's just sort of, it's almost a separate thing. It's this etiquette that's in place.
Right. And you do mention the concept of privilege in some ways originates with Peggy McIntosh's article, because that was the first major article taking this perspective. And I've had, when I first read it, I had mixed reactions to it. Overall, I think it's not an article where McIntosh really argues that people need to constantly check their privilege. It's an article that helps you take the perspective of someone who's African-American in the United States, if you're white. And so How do you think we ended up starting with an article like that, that helped you with perspective taking, and ended up in a culture where we're now expecting people to do that all the time?
Well, I think if you look at what, so just in terms of where the concept of privilege comes from, I mean, I don't go into every single like historical facet of where it comes up, but that, the Peggy McIntosh concept of a unpacking the knapsack, that is really where privilege in the way it's discussed today, I think, comes from. And I think that if you look at her checklist, and this is something I discuss a bit in my book, basically some of the things she lists as her privileges as a white person in America have to do with exactly that. Others have to do with being Peggy McIntosh in America and her social class, her career, her specificity just in general. Like certain things didn't really add up as having to do with whiteness. Others did. So where I think this matters in general in terms of how this has played out is that I think what's happened, and I think, and I write about this, and this is, I think, if anything, become more the case, at least as much the case since I was writing this, but something has happened in this conversation, not our conversation, but I mean like the cultural conversation about privilege, where white privilege and socioeconomic privilege get kind of mixed up in this way where the people who are most vocally sort of apologizing for or showcasing or whatever you want to call it, their white privilege tend to be people who are also privileged in other ways. And then you get people who are white but not otherwise privileged saying, wait a second, that's not me. And then you get this whole, no wait, but they have to acknowledge their white privilege. And it's like, they are privileged insofar as they're white, but they're not privileged in all the other ways that somebody like Peggy McIntosh might be. And then I think that that has sort of muddled things and this whole notion that it's also sort of made it seem as though the problem is that people who have unearned advantages need to just get it together and realize that they should shed those unearned advantages. And I think the problem with this is that most people, regardless of, you know, demographic traits, feel that they don't have enough and are probably right about that. So this notion that, you know, that doesn't give them an excuse to be, you know, bigoted. It does, however, mean that an approach of anti-bigotry that says you need to apologize for having everything isn't going to work because they don't think they have everything and they don't have everything and they're not wrong, if that makes sense. So that's one thing I think that's happened with sort of how it got to where it is today. Then the other is just this notion of sort of privilege checking as a kind of online activity that's sort of like with BuzzFeed quizzes, like how privileged are you and things like this. And it's very shareable content, both online and like in classrooms. It's just, there's a lot of kind of activities that can go with checking one's privilege. And there, I think the issue is partly that I think there's something I find disturbing about this kind of requirement that you share everything about yourself. And this assumption that if people, is this weird assumption today that people are doing so, and that if you haven't shared a specific obstacle, you can't possibly have had that obstacle, and thus your privilege. So it's this weird thing where people are kind of put into this bind where either they explain exactly every obstacle they've ever faced to everybody at all times, like online or whatever, or in a classroom. Or it's as good as they're admitting that they've never faced any obstacles and they just kind of have to nod along to that.
So what do you suggest as a solution? I know that's not your area of specialty. You're more of a critical scholar, but when you were asked to talk about solutions, what do you suggest?
Yeah, it's tricky. So I think a lot of times people have asked me, so what should you do if you feel like calling out somebody's privilege? What should you say instead of check your privilege? And there, my perhaps disappointing answer is sometimes nothing. Sometimes you need to think about why it is you're wanting to say this. If you just are kind of trying to point out in an internet argument that somebody else is privileged and there's really no end goal beyond that, I mean, if you're doing it just to vent, and fine, go ahead, you know, then there isn't really any point in an alternative. But if you're trying to have a sort of productive conversation about something, it's possible that nothing is gained by alerting somebody to their privilege and that finding different wording isn't really the answer. And especially if it's about like cultural criticism, you know, maybe framing everything in terms of privilege to begin with isn't necessarily even the right approach. Like this whole question of like punch up, punch down and all of this, like maybe the framework itself is the issue. But if you want to actually sort of change things substantively, I think what's useful is to just look at where there are actual substantive issues you think should be different. So I think about the difference between, just to give a sort of more concrete example of this, the difference between seeking out universal healthcare. So I'm American, but I live in Canada and I am loving the universal healthcare here. And, you know, I think about the difference between either, you know, choosing candidates, supporting presidential candidates who would get to that goal, and acknowledging and the difference between that on the one hand and being, you know, like a sort of pedant in online arguments about acknowledging the privilege that comes with having health insurance in the States. You know, I think these are, or calling people out if they haven't been properly aware of the fact that not everybody has the same access to healthcare. So that's where I think, like, I think it's just, I think this notion that the solution lies in everybody becoming aware of their privileges is just inaccurate and counterproductive. So it's not that I think that the problem is that the word privilege has become some sort of too fraught thing and people are too, you know, sensitive. I mean, people get defensive if they perceive that they're being criticized, whatever the wording. But so that's one area I would change. And the other is that I think precision. So I think if somebody is being racist, sexist, homophobic, whatever it is, and you want to call that out, call it out using those terms. Whereas privilege just, I think, is too abstract and is too likely to just kind of suggest that somebody is rich, let's say, if they're not. And that could be just confusing rather than kind of pointing out what the actual issue is.
And what sort of critiques have you received for the book that you find interesting?
I mean, some of the critiques are ones that I entirely agree with. And I sort of like make them of it myself, which is that it just couldn't do everything. So it's not like the full history of the use of the term privilege that it might have been with like infinite time and resources towards it.
I think other people may have done that already too.
I would have liked that, but because I did look into that as background and nobody had done that. That's open, I believe. Somebody can do that. There are privilege readers, like, but the history of the term privilege, no. And I had originally hoped to do more in that area. And also just, there are a whole bunch of different paths that this could have gone down, potentially some that would have interested me, others that would have just not really been my area. So couldn't do everything. And that's always, I think, for any author going to be a regret that a book couldn't do absolutely everything. But ideologically, I mean, I think some people probably perceived it. I'm just trying, because like it came out in 2017. So I'm trying to remember exactly, I guess, and I think this is just a function of kind of the media environment in general, that this was a book by somebody who had it with being called out for privilege and was getting really in a huff. And that's really not what it is at all, because I haven't ever been canceled or whatever. You know, I'm not like, because sometimes people have wanted me to tell the story of my cancellation. And I was like, well, this is not a thing that's happened to me. So like, I've read about these things, but this is not what this is. And it's not a memoir, you know, right. But I mean, I think there are a lot of people, I guess the biggest, I'd say like from the left pushback has been kind of like, no, it's really, really important to talk about privilege because it is. And when I see in forums online where people say like content warning privilege, like obviously I've lost, you know, I've lost this argument, like in public opinion, in some respects. I also have a lot of people agree with me a lot about it. So I think the general trend is for, it is very important to all talk about our privilege. And if anything, that's become more so since I wrote this book, which is kind of frustrating. And then from the right, I think it's more, that I don't think that the general progressive assessment of who has it easiest and who has it most difficult is inaccurate. And I think, you know, from the right, that's a problem because, you know, I have a progressive outlook on this. And like the things that progressives generally want changed when they talk about privilege are things that I also want changed. So I'm pointing out hypocrisies and inconsistencies, but I'm not saying that the whole thing is wrong. And I guess, oh, this is actually really sort of the most important criticism that I've gotten that I really, really wish I would have sort of anticipated and preemptively pushed back against in the book is that it's a lot about the internet. And it is. It is unabashedly a lot about people arguing online. Some of that has to do with the sort of the conditions of production, like how, you know, how I was able to write the book, you know, while working, things like this. But a lot of it, in fact, I would even say nearly all of it has to do with what I wanted to write about. Like, these are debates that are happening online. And because of having started this topic, starting being interested in this topic about a decade ago now, really, and just in an era when, like, it was a big deal if an academic had a blog, it was like, oh no, like, what if people find out that they have a blog? That might be a problem. It, like, that was kind of the era I came up in a way. And I think I thought you just had to kind of like be much more tentative about talking about the internet. Like, this is just a little thing, you know, people arguing online. And now it's like, I mean, the US president is on Twitter arguing online. You know what I mean? Like, this is no longer seen as something, you know, like most people are meeting their spouses online, you know, things like that. It's no longer considered not real life anymore, something marginal to where things are really happening. And I think what I was trying to highlight in the book about the way privilege checking functions online, when people often don't know at all who they're talking to, they don't know their demographics, they don't know their identities, they don't know anything, but they just get these senses of, oh, this is a fancy person, this is a not fancy person, this person, you know, and you get people who are Black and they're called out for their white privilege by people who just didn't know that or weren't paying attention, you know, because they're not seeing each other. People are not interacting, you know, face-to-face. Often it could just be avatars and pseudonyms.
Yeah, I mean, that happened to me. I'm Indian, ethnically, South Asian Indian, and I've had...
Have you been called out for your white privilege?
Once, yeah. I guess just once, so maybe that's just so minor now that it's not a big deal. But yeah, there was one time because, I have a white name, Chris Martin. It's a Christian name, so I think someone just assumed I was white.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I've heard a lot of similar stories. I even encountered something similar to that in a review of this book where somebody was sort of saying that I was sort of like blithely unaware of the severity of being trolled by Nazis online. And I had to actually, as much as this breaches all sorts of author etiquette, go into the comments and be like, hi, I'm Jewish. Like, I am white. I'm also Jewish. The Nazi trolls have come for me. That was literally like what this part of my book was about. But I don't know. I think this is something though where this is much more the case online though, where people don't know who they're talking to and assume privilege. And I think that, yeah. So just in terms of like pushback that I've gotten, I think, some of it was, this is not the sort of book history that it should be. This is all about these websites. And I very meticulously have like links in the index to a lot of websites. You know, people are like, oh, that's not done. But I feel like I wish I would have, there was like one review of it, possibly by a law professor, that was like defending me for having done this. And I thought, wow, I should have kind of like done that in the book. Have defended myself for doing this a little bit more, because I think it matter, the discussions online matter, and it matters that they're happening online for how people talk to one another.
Right. Yeah, I think there's still an age division to some degree. I'm not sure how many people over the age of, I don't know, 45 or 50 are very active on the kinds of forums like Tumblr that younger people are active on.
Oh, I've never been active on Tumblr. I don't know. I think Twitter is probably, I don't know what the actual age breakdown is, but I feel like there's a lot of people active on Twitter who are over 45. But,
right. Yeah. The Twitter, I don't know. I sometimes think about, I know there's a lot of research out there on political debates on Twitter and whether people cluster or form silos. Mm-hmm. What I don't know is how many people on Twitter are just there for the sports or mm-hmm. something else and not really into politics at all. And there might be a bit of an age breakdown there too. There's definitely some people who are there mm-hmm. for the music discussions and sports discussions and not the politics
for sure.
at all.
For sure. Whenever I look for just some search term for something I'm writing and I put in a term and I am suddenly confronted with the whole world of Twitter that isn't the people I follow, the first thing I notice isn't, oh, they have different politics from the people I follow. It's like they are there for like K-pop or something totally random that is not at all the topics that, I mean, well, some people I follow are into that, but I'm saying like, you just see that it's like a wide range of interests that people have, and it's not, not everybody is talking about whether you're more privileged if you support Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Like, not everybody's having that conversation.
Do you have any future projects that are in the works right now, another book or articles or anything like that?
I mean, what I am writing about is sort of female sexuality, specifically heterosexuality, in our era. So that's what I'm generally writing about. But nothing to point anyone to just yet.
Well, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can follow Phoebe on Twitter at Tweetertation. It's spelled like dissertation, except with tweet at the beginning. You can also listen to her show, Feminine Chaos, or watch it. It's co-hosted with Kat Rosenfeld. Online, you can watch it at bloggingheads.tv. As a podcast, you can catch it on any major podcast app. I've included a couple of links to reviews of her books in the show notes for this episode, and a couple of links to articles by her. There's also a link to the article, White Privilege: Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, by Peggy McIntosh, which we discussed in the episode. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on iTunes, because it helps more people find out about the show, which is really valuable to us. Also, since this is still around Thanksgiving, I'd like to thank you for being loyal listeners to the show, and I hope you enjoy the episodes coming up in December. We have Carol Quillen, president of Davidson College, and Deb Mashek, executive director of Heterodox Academy.
This podcast is produced by Heterodox Academy. Find us online at heterodoxacademy.org, on Twitter at HDX Academy, and on Facebook.